You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Barry Schwabsky. He is the art critic for The Nation, and he also has a new book out called Words for Art. Barry, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, my pleasure.
As critic for The Nation, you're filling the shoes of different critics, or maybe I shouldn't say filling the shoes, but there's a line of critics that have worked for The Nation, and you know, in my mind, they're all major figures, important people. Arthur Danto is probably my favorite critic, or was my favorite critic. I really loved his work, and it seems that all the critics have also looked at art through a particular lens. Arthur Danto, you know, through his background in philosophy, through that lens. As you write for The Nation, is there a particular lens or viewpoint that you write through, do you think, that informs your writing?
A couple of things there. One is that, it's the wonderful thing for me about writing for The Nation is the fact that I'm always conscious that I am somehow a successor to Arthur Danto, to Lawrence Alloway, to Max Kozloff, to Fairfield Porter, to Clement Greenberg. And, you know, you really feel like you've got to do your best.
Right.
You've got to push yourself and represent. And so I love the fact that it makes me do that. It's a wonderful thing. Now, in terms of Danto, I think what's interesting, though, is that although he was a philosopher, and when I was an undergraduate philosophy major and took a course in aesthetics, our course started with his essay, The Art World. That was the beginning of the kind of contemporary Anglo-American philosophical aesthetics. So he was a big deal in that field. But in many ways, I would say, even though he obviously cited philosophy a lot in his reviews, one of the things I liked about him as a critic is that he didn't specifically come to art as a philosopher. He wrote about art really as someone who loved art and was open to lots of things and didn't impose his angle on it. He wanted to get from it what it had, whatever it had to give. And that's something I'm very sympathetic to. So I would say in the same way that, you know, like him, I have another hat. I'm not as distinguished in it as he was in his, but I write poetry as well as writing art criticism. But that doesn't mean that I come to art from a literary viewpoint or from ideas about poetry. Again, I try and come to each thing for what it is and what it has to give. And so in that sense, maybe someone could accuse me of not bringing a specific enough position to art, but I think I always bring something to it. Anyway.
Well, I mean, coming in, approaching it as a poet, even if that isn't the intention of how you're approaching it, but as an artist, as a poet, I would imagine that you're also approaching art with a sympathetic point of view to the community of artists that you understand, because you are one in crafting poetry. And to me, the reason I'm saying that is because I wonder whether that leads to less, and I don't want to say critical thinking, because of course it's all critical thinking, but we often think of critics as these people who, you know, shred artist shows or you know, or do these kind of things. And Arthur Danto, to me, was in part wonderful because he didn't do that. He seemed to be reviewing the things that he liked, rarely took anybody to task, and I mean, I don't want to say any more about what he said, because I interviewed him as well quite a while ago, but he, do you feel that because you have that approach, or not that approach, that background, because it's maybe too much to say what your approach is, but does that make you more sympathetic and less classically critical of what's good or bad in artwork?
Well, it's funny, because I think it's true that he kind of took the position that he, if he was going to write about it, that in itself meant that he was taking a stance that this is something interesting and important. And he was not, therefore, you know, he might have certain reservations which he would articulate, but fundamentally, this was, he was writing about something that he thought was pretty good. I think I'm a little bit more, in your sense, critical than that. I don't feel like I write a tremendous amount of terribly scathing reviews, but I write quite a few that are pretty mixed, and some that are pretty negative. You know, I have to say, for instance, that you know, someone like Dan Graham is so loved by so many people and such a cult figure that when I wrote my review of his show at the Whitney Museum a few years ago, I almost was afraid I was going to get drummed out of the art world for saying that fundamentally he wasn't a very good artist in the end. And I was surprised to discover that I felt that. It wasn't as if I went into the show thinking that that's what I was going to say. I went into the show actually never having seen a big show of his, having seen lots of work of his over the years, thinking I was going to come out much more positive than it turned out to be. But I had to call it as I saw it.
Well, that is powerful, because, of course, Dan Graham is this, you know, almost legendary figure, but at the same time, it's important that careers, as they evolve and as we look back on them, get reevaluated. I mean, you know, there's... it's interesting that you say that about Dan Graham. He's someone that I admire, but in a sense does seem to me, I remember when I saw his work at DIA in the 80s and 90s, and the work that he continues to do, and it seemed, I didn't read that article that you wrote on him, but he seemed like the kind of artist, and maybe there's maybe several of that generation that made work that were a little, was maybe a little lukewarm compared to his early work. Mm-hmm. Why did you feel that he wasn't as good an artist as you thought?
I felt like in his early work, he was kind of articulating a lot of different ideas that I wouldn't say were necessarily derivative of other artists, because he may even have originated them, but that were in circulation in that time and place among a group of artists, simply most of whom did more with the ideas than he did, whoever really originated them first, which I think is now very hard to reconstruct because things are happening so fast.
Sure.
And then in his later work, I think he just became very very repetitive, and in a sense, unimaginative. Mm.
And an artist, in contrary to that, that you would champion or think is doing work that continues to evolve and is vital would be?
Well, let's see. I mean, just to take someone, there are a lot of people, obviously,
of course,
that I could name that way, but someone coming from a similar place, Lawrence Weiner immediately comes to mind as someone who I think has, you know, maintained a very steady kind of trajectory, but continues to infuse it with new content and to make an exploration out of the paradigm that he set up back in those days.
Let's talk about Lawrence Weiner a little bit, because I think he's a fascinating artist, and I've seen quite a bit of his work, but probably not nearly as much as he puts out there. What do you think is happening with his work from the early work, and how he is continuing to? I mean, can you illustrate a little bit what you're saying in terms of how he's growing as an artist and continues to evolve, essentially?
It's a little hard to be that specific without a kind of, you know, like a book here for us to look at or something to point to. But in a kind of general sense, I'd say, well, first of all, he continues to try and find new ways to to do what his work has always been about, which is somehow the relationship between language and materials. Hmm. And sometimes that involves using different mediums to do it, like the fact that he will make kind of animated videos, which is not something that you would have immediately thought would have come out of his earlier work, or simply to present new works, which just bring out different aspects of his ideas about materials, or of move, you know, how things move from place to place or from context to context.
That's interesting, because it's true. It seems to be that, from what I know of Lawrence Weiner, that he is always working with different mediums. Mm-hmm. When I think of his work, I think of installations that I've seen at PS1 or DIA, and they tend to be these often words, mm-hmm. or text on, mm-hmm. on a wall somehow. Mm-hmm. But of course, he's made books, and
mm-hmm. his books are great.
Yeah, the books are wonderful, and books in very different mm-hmm. ways. Yeah. He's made small artist books, mm-hmm. published books with artist book publishers. Mm-hmm.
Collaborations also with other artists that are always quite interesting. Mm. Yeah.
Collaborations. I don't know a lot about a lot of his collaborative
work. Some of his books have been collaborations with photographers and with other artists. And somehow they're things that really bring both of their works together in a very satisfying way.
Which is kind of nice, because so often, I think especially... maybe not especially now, but artists typically have a very strong egos, mm-hmm. right? You know, we were talking before about an artist in the collection, and I was mentioning how she was saying, you know, she is kind of white hot, and this kind of, you know, charm mm-hmm. that comes in a sense from that kind of ego and sense mm-hmm. of self. But occasionally it also makes them less collaborative, I would think, mm-hmm. or can narrow a field mm-hmm. And be less collaborative. So I think there's also something about Lawrence Weiner in that respect that's quite generous, and that mm-hmm. allows the conversation to, if this makes sense, to develop in a way mm-hmm. that it wouldn't if he's alone in his studio with 10 assistants even.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. What was the last show you've seen of his, or the last work you've seen of his?
It's been a little while since I've seen a show of his. I couldn't really say offhand.
Yeah, I think the last work I saw of his was at DIA, which was quite a while ago. And I had always thought he was not working in so many mediums till I saw books and all kinds of different things that mm-hmm. he has done.
Yeah, and kind of objects that he makes as kind of multiples that where he deploys some of his texts and so on. I remember once a long time ago I curated a show and put in a piece of his that was a sailor's cap, and I can't remember the text that was on it. Something about the stars, which is a kind of recurrent image of his, because he's, you know, so much of his work is about the sea and sailing, and about the idea of the sailor sailing, you know, setting his course by the star. And I think the actual, what can I say, poetic subject matter of his work is not sufficiently attended to. People are, you know, much more impressed at first by simply the fact that, oh, you know, it's words on a wall, and, you know, his idea that he famously encapsulated early on about how the artist need not make the work, or someone else could make the work, or the work, you know, I forget exactly what the three kind of axioms are, but people are, you know, remember that more than they somehow noticed, well, okay, but what are all these things add up to? There's a kind of, what can I say, a philosophy of life there that's poetically thought through.
I understand that. I think that's an interesting thing to explore. So there's, as you're saying, sometimes the poetics of his work, or what is poetic about his work, isn't as recognized or as prominent as what's happening formally. And that's something that's kind of hard to grasp, seems a little nebulous. And as a poet, I'm interested in asking you about this, because that's one of those things that I think all artists want, you know, to make work that is poetic somehow. But what does that mean? You know, I mean, I know that's wide open, but what does that mean for some of, you could even, you know, explain it literally or conceptually, but what does that mean for some of Lawrence Winter's work to have, Wiener's work to have a poetic quality, and what does that mean perhaps in general for visual art?
Yeah. To me, I think what people mean by that, and what I would probably mean by it if I used it in this context, is simply to say it's something that resonates beyond what the thing literally is, and has potential meaning for many, many different contexts. I think that's how I would sum it up.
There seems to be something, I mean, I agree that, and that makes sense to me, but there's often something that's, and perhaps this is a judgment call, which I'd like to talk a little bit about as well. But it's one thing to resonate on many different levels. It's another thing to be poetic, which to me somehow means there's something almost impossible to articulate that moves you in a way that isn't about form. You know, that is psychological, emotional, has some kind of depth to it that it doesn't appear at first.
Well, I understand what you're saying, but those are forms too, if you know what I mean. So I wouldn't put it in opposition to form. I put it, as I say, I put it more in opposition to literalism. Something that I would give, and again, kind of maybe sticking to this, an example from the same generation, something that struck me when I read it a long time ago was in an interview with Joseph Kosuth, and he said that the first work that he made that he was satisfied with as a work was when he decided that a work shouldn't be a sculpture, and it shouldn't be a painting, and it shouldn't represent anything. And so he took a mirror and leaned it from the floor against the wall. And since it was not on the floor entirely, it wasn't a sculpture, and since it wasn't on the wall, it was not a painting, and since it was a mirror, it didn't represent anything. So this is the first time he did something that satisfied his criteria for a contemporary work, as he understood that it should be. And you know, whatever you might want to say about work that he did later, you know, I think when you think about what that work could have been, if you would see it, which of course I haven't, it seems like it's something that simply fulfills its criteria, and then there's nothing extra. beyond that. And so that's what I mean by something that's kind of fixed in the literal sense of what it is, and doesn't have this extra something which we're calling poetic.
Right. I mean, for me, of an artist that reflects that, that's not of that generation, would be perhaps Ad Reinhardt or some of the color field painters, which perhaps is another example, as I'm understanding what you're saying, which are operating on very formal rules. But to me, when I look at some of the Ad Reinhardt black paintings, I find them enormously powerful. Mm-hmm. Not just what's happening optically and visually, but, you know, the idea of, you know, what's initially your eyes are kind of open to a new reality. Didn't see those squares at first. Didn't see that cross at first. And I don't know if that's in between.
Well,
but.
Well, I mean, it doesn't mean that something can't be, to all appearances, utterly simple and still have this poetic quality. For sure, I think Reinhardt's work did.
The role of the critic is something that people seem to feel occupies a number of different definitions for different people. We talked a little bit about Arthur Danto. For him, it's obviously, I think, a different role than for someone like Jerry Saltz. When I was asking Arthur specifically about people like Jerry and Roberta, although Arthur tends to be incredibly democratic, he felt that that that's not the role a critic should take. A critic should not be telling artists what to do or what not to do. You know, they can be doing whatever they want, but felt that it not that they couldn't be critical or take an artist to task, but you can't say, oh, you can't get away with that, or that can't be done.
I think he's wrong. I think he was wrong, and the reason is that if an artist can say that to him or herself, then I can say it to him or her. You know, I think that the critic is simply a kind of development and formalization as a separate role of something that every artist is involved in when they're doing their work. And there is always some point when you are looking at what you do and saying to yourself, is this any good? You know, if not, why not? If so, why? What do I need to do to make it more what it is? And so it's not that I think that the role of the critic is essentially to be a kind of you know, like Saint Peter at the gates of heaven, say, you're in, you're out, you're out, you're out, you're out, you're in. No, that's not interesting. But and I understand that Roberta in particular, who, you know, I think is a tremendous critic, a tremendous writer of criticism, you know, has this habit of sounding, at times, of sounding a little bit like a schoolteacher and telling the artist, you should do this. But you know what? You know, she's ultimately, you're not getting a report card from her, you know, that's going on your heavenly transcript. You can listen to what she says or not listen to what she says. You know, I think she understands the responsibility of her, of what she's doing and of her influence. But I think every artist who puts their work out there in public also understands that they're opening themselves up to all kinds of judgments, and some of those judgments might involve someone thinking that they have a better idea of what you should be doing than you have, then they might even be right.
That makes sense to me. That is a bit of a projection, though, isn't it? I mean, I see it as what you're saying now is there's a the critic plays the role of enabling checks and balances. It's not simply if the artist says it's done, or if it works, it works. There's feedback that's involved from critics and others who are attuned visually, critically, conceptually to artwork and have a sense of what's happening in the art world. And I admire and I think it's important for artists to have that kind of feedback, in a sense. Without it, you know, it's like publishing a book and never getting a review or never getting any feedback. It's hard to tell what's really happening with the art in the world. Is that distinct from, because it seems to be in my mind, from saying about an artist like William Kentridge, oh, you can't get away with having gallery shows, you're an animator, you can't do gallery shows, that's not the kind of artist you are. Is that something that seems, and that's a, you know.
Did someone say that?
Jerry Salt said that, yeah.
That's funny.
At a lecture with Arthur Danto, which is why Arthur Danto used that, and Arthur Danto thought, he doesn't really have the right to say that.
Of course he has the right to say that. If he's allowed to go into the gallery, then he's allowed to say what he thinks about what's there and whether it makes any sense to be there. I think he's wrong in this particular instance, but I think he's right to think that it's his right to say that. I, for instance, have a little bit of a a problem with certain artists who do work that is primarily not gallery-based work, and they're, you know, what people call social interventions or other kinds of things that take place in, you know, real time in the real world and so on. And
would graffiti artists fall into that rubric, like Banksy, or you're talking more about?
No, because they're making a picture and they're putting it on a wall.
Right. Performance-based artists.
Collaborative, these kind of collaborative performative projects that some people do. And then they, very often when they try and manifest that in the gallery through some kind of documentation or text or whatever, it really doesn't make any sense or come to life. It really would have been better if it almost devalues to some extent what they're doing in that other proper context that the work has.
Because it looks just like kind of documentation derivative of the primary work, which is the social intervention or performance or whatever it is.
Yeah. And, for instance, I someone I admire a lot, who you probably haven't heard of, and the reason you haven't heard of him is because he never does this, is an Israeli artist called Avital Geva, and he was kind of one of the kind of conceptual political artists of Israel in the 1970s and became very well known there, and he eventually started to do a work which is a greenhouse that exists in a kibbutz somewhere in Israel, and basically as he got more involved in doing this, he became less involved in doing activities within the official art world, but he was asked to represent Israel in the 1993, I think it was, Venice Biennale, and he tried to represent his greenhouse in the Israeli pavilion there, and then after that he realized that he could never express this project within a kind of the walls of a gallery situation, and he's never had anything to do with exhibiting his work since then, but he still continues to work as an artist on this project, and there's no documentation per se of it anywhere. There are no photographs that are circulating or anything. you know, if you're interested in it, you have to go there and see it and talk to him, and it's just a thing that he does. And maybe some people don't need to see it as art. He sees it as art, and certain other people see it as art, and others don't.
Tino Segal would be an example of that, wouldn't he, or no?
I would say he's the opposite. His work really...
There's no documentation of his work.
But it depends on being in an art context. Hmm. And
right, he's not taking place outside the art context, which is initially what you were saying.
Yeah.
Well, maybe a different example would be two artists I'm thinking of is Marina Abramović and Zhang Wan. I don't know if you know Zhang Wan's work.
No, I don't.
Chinese artist who initially did, I think, a meat suit at the
oh yeah, yeah, I've seen Venice images Biennial, of that. Yeah,
but he's also done enormous images of kind of himself with writing all over his face. Mm-hmm. He, you know, initially got known for doing these works in China that for him was trying to emulate the East Village in the 80s, mm-hmm. and it was, you know, sitting in a urinal covered with, you know, a public urinal covered with honey and covered with flies
as well. And but you see, those are very striking images, and clearly they've been
right.
They're not taking place in a normal art context, but they're also being thought through from the beginning as something that will become an image. And so I can see that it makes perfect sense to display that image
right
in an art gallery among other images, but there are other projects that don't have to do with
creating an image. Let's say Marina Abramović seems to be an example of an artist whose images, because I like both artists' work. I'm interested in a lot of artists. Zhang Wan's images, right, absolutely mm-hmm. look like they're striking. They're powerful mm-hmm. on their own. They stand on their own, even though you don't know whether or not he was in a urinal or what mm-hmm. that performance was, or public bathroom. Marina Abramović would be a different case because, or no, because she's creating work that seems to me to be entirely about the performance. Mm-hmm. But ever since her first shows, even years ago, where mm-hmm. she was making these chairs, there were always these kind of derivative things mm-hmm. that never sold. Mm-hmm. I think recently they're maybe selling more, but
probably,
initially
yeah.
the chairs with the crystals in them, none of that sold.
Mm-hmm.
Is she an example of that kind of crossover that's not working, that should be left kind of undocumented? Or
no, I don't see why. You know, she's making objects, okay. You know, they're props for performances or not, but they're objects and they have an existence like any other object, and there's an aesthetic that goes into the making of them, and it seems, again, to make perfect sense that you would put it in a gallery. You know, I'm thinking more, well, I don't know, one thing that I remember made a big impression on me years ago, and again, I never actually saw it, but just knowing about it, an artist called Michael Bramwell, who was doing a project that simply had to do with going to a certain apartment building and sweeping in the public spaces of the building every day, you know. Now, maybe there are pictures of him sweeping somewhere. I don't feel like I ever had to see them. It wouldn't be very interesting for me probably to go to a gallery and see a picture of a guy sweeping, although if it was a great photographer, you know, you can make a beautiful image of that, but then it would be the photographer's image and not the performer's. No, it's simply an action that is being done outside, and it's not being done for the gallery, but it's being done as an artist's intervention in a real place. And I think it's very satisfying that it stayed there, and that in a sense I can only know about it sort of through hearsay and not through trying to make a visual representation of it that can be put into a gallery.
Hmm. Let's talk about your book, Words for Art. When did this book come out?
It's just come out this fall from Sternberg Press in Germany, and it took there was a little bit of a delay in the American distributor getting it, but it's now available here in the U.S. as well.
And tell us a little bit about that. What is this book about for you?
Well, the subtitle of the book is Criticism, History, Theory, Practice, which may seem to encompass just about everything. But what it means is that this is a collection of critical essays about art writing and art writers. And when I say art writers, I'm including art critics, I'm including art historians, philosophers, sociologists, and artists. Because, of course, artists also write about art.
And the particular viewpoint in this book is, what do you think it's giving the reader? What are they left with? What was the idea behind putting together this particular group of writings?
Well, it's a group of writings that I've written actually over 20. It's funny, they're 20 essays, and they've been written over about 20 years. So for different contexts, and about very different kinds of writers, and it's from that point of view simply about exploring how one can come to think and write about art from so many different angles.
Talking about writing about art and artists, and especially the fact that you're a poet, there's a context, a market that artists are working in now, right? Let's say you're a young artist, or emerging artist, mid-career artist, whatever the term is, and the equivalent for a poet. You know, you're a young poet, mid-career poet. Artists now have this this notion that it's real, that it's possible to enter the marketplace and not only make a living, perhaps, but also a very good living, perhaps. It's a very recent development, right, in the last, maybe since the 80s. Poets, on the other hand, are operating in a context, in a world where that isn't available, or doesn't seem to be one of the goals, to either make money as a poet, make a living as a poet, or make a very good living as a poet.
It depends a little bit what you mean by making a living as a poet. Certainly there are very few poets who make a living of any livable sort entirely from, let's say, the royalties of the sale of their books and fees for doing readings, which I guess you would say is the most immediate way. John Ashray does. Allen Ginsberg did when he was alive. I presume Billy Collins does. You know, a few. Ann Carson, maybe. But lots of poets make a living as teachers, and they're teaching poetry. You know, they're in universities, and they see a continuity between their work as a professor and their work as a poet. And so I think they would say that they make a living via poetry. I never, you know, decided to go that way. And in a certain sense, I think I kind of take a position that as a poet, I'm a dilettante, and I'm going to write as a dilettante and make a kind of program out of that, although that's paradoxical.
Whereas artists have this notion that, you know, they can also teach, maybe produce work as a dilettante, in a sense, as you were saying, with or without a program. There's always this idea of...
Well, the art world is very... has a very narrow view of what constitutes a career of an artist, and it's okay to have a job as a teacher in an art school, but other than that, it's highly disapproved of to have any other kind of work. And I remember, for instance, when I I wrote something. It was in a book review about an artist, and this guy, in addition to being an artist, is also an actor in porn films. And I referred to it as his day job. And I got a very angry email from him because he felt that that implied that he couldn't make a living as an artist and had to have a different job. And he was insistent that it be clear that that's not the case, that he just likes to do this other thing. And he can very easily support himself just from the sale of his art. And I thought, well, okay, you know, if that's important to you, you know, fine. I don't understand why it has to be so important to somebody that people think that. You know,
that people think that their career must not be mentioned.
Nobody ever thought that it impugned William Carlos Williams's status as a poet to mention that he was a baby doctor. You know, he was a full-time physician in Rutherford, New Jersey. He apparently delivered Robert Smithson into the world, among many thousands of others.
Wow.
Nobody thought that was a problem. You know, nobody thought it was a problem that Wallace Stevens was an insurance executive. But
so why
the idea that an artist would have another profession is something that's not really countenanced by the art world that we know it. And frankly, I think it's ridiculous. I think, you know, art, if in certain ways, and that's one of them, the art world can be one of the most narrow-minded places that there is, even though theoretically we're all trying to open our imaginations.
Right, that's interesting. I know I felt that as in a different way, another sort of unwritten rule, or maybe it was my own thinking, but you know, my wife and I worked together as artists and we had a child. A child in the art world doesn't seem very cool, you know, or that's how we felt at the time. And so you would need to go to an opening or something. Had to find a way to get there, you know, get a babysitter or something, you know. But when it's an infant, of course, you can't really do that, and it's tricky. And it seems there's different views on that. There was one time when we were talking to a curator at the Whitney Museum. Our child is, you know, in childcare or something, and she's saying to us, maybe you would be good for doing, you know, you could do this kind of a tour or something. And she did know we had a child. And I said, well, you know, we could do that, but there's another artist that was just in the biennial that would be perfect for that. Why wouldn't you put him in for that position? And she said, well, I just love working with people who have kids. And it was just shocking to me, you know, because it's the kind of thing we're trying to hide all the time and never say, you know, here's our kid or here's our picture or something. So why is that? I mean, in one sense, it seems that if that artist that you're talking about said, I have this job in pornography during the day, and this informs my work or has something to do with my work, that might be okay then, if it's embraced.
Well, it does have to do with this work. I mean, he you know, why? Zach Smith is his name. He shows at Frederick's Streiser Gallery. I mean, he has a whole series of drawings that he's exhibited of fellow, you know, porn actresses, and I mean, so it's not that he hides the fact that he does this. And it was in this book, you know, I was reviewing a book of his. It's discussed in the book. But what he didn't like is that I called it a day job, which he thought implied that he needed to do it for money.
Right. And we don't, and the ruling ethic seems to me, we don't want to talk about, or artists shouldn't be talking about what they're doing for money.
Well, they should be selling their artwork for money. Is, you know, they should be successful as artists.
Do you think that's a destructive notion? I mean, it seems to me kind of silly as well, as you're saying that not only that never used to be the case, that certainly isn't a problem with poets and plenty of other fields. Why has that happened?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, really. But, you know, I think it's so interesting that, you know, everyone in the art world proclaims their devotion to Marcel Duchamp and the idea that Duchamp was, you know, really kind of the beginning of the kind of art that we mostly are involved with today and so on, and was the greatest influence. But the one influence that nobody takes from him is the fact that he proclaimed that the great artists of tomorrow will go underground, and that, you know, he himself never wanted to make a living as an artist. If anything, he made a living as an art dealer or art consultant in a certain way. He never wanted to be dependent on the sale of his own work, which he felt might impinge on his freedom of thought to decide what he wanted to do as an artist. And then finally, of course, for the last few years of his life, he falsely claimed that he wasn't making art anymore, so they could make his work in complete privacy.
There's so many things about Duchamp that's a complete mystery, and seems to have several readings available of so many of his words and actions. As what you're just saying, I remember the line that came to mind for me as soon as you started talking about him was him saying, I remember someone came from a lecture at MoMA, and they were talking about Duchamp and him talking, and one of the things, the interview, I think it was Barry or somebody years ago interviewing him at MoMA, and this is, what are you most proud of? And he said that I've never had a job. And, you know, the woman that said that, so, you know, that was just the most wonderful thing. But like so many things that Duchamp said, that seems to have multiple meanings, mm-hmm. right? Apparently, I never knew what he did do for work. I thought he had a patron, Catherine Dreyer. I don't know who else. I imagined he was getting money from other places. He was also an art consultant.
Well, he was. I mean, yeah, that's what he was doing for Catherine Dreyer and for what's the other one, John Quinn. I mean, he was getting works from Brancusi and, you know, finding places for them. And yeah, of course, that was really what he, and he didn't live on very much, I think. It's not like he was, you know, doing this all the time or making, having a kind of agency operating in this way. He simply did what he needed to do. Yes, to not have a job, not to have to go to an office, but also not to have to depend on making money through his art.
That's true. It seems that there's different meanings of what that means to not have a job. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm also in a position like that, and it wasn't long ago that I feel better about this now. But I said at my father's funeral, when I was giving a talk and talking about how my father raised me to some degree, I said one of the things that, you know, I'm proud of is I've never had to have a job. And, you know, my son, who was like 11 at the time, said to me afterwards, what are you talking about, you never had a job? That sounds terrible. That sounds like you don't work or do anything. And I said, well, that's not what I meant, you know. But that means different things to different people, right? We have different meanings of that. When Duchamp says, I never had a job, that can be read as he's only making his living off his art, or that it's coming to him by windfall, trust fund, something else, but is never read as you're homeless, for example, right? It's never quite read that way, it seems. In concluding, I want to talk about, which seems to segue into what we're discussing now, how artists, what they're faced with now in terms of building a career, right? You're in a major city or not, which is also a powerful point, you know. What are artists facing in terms of, and do you think it's very different now in terms of, they want to be an artist. They get an MFA or a BFA and then decide to have shows, exhibit. Is there something particularly different happening today for artists wanting to engage the art world? And if so, what is it? And
That's a complicated question. I guess it sort of asks for a certain amount of prognostication or divination to think about, well, where, not where are we now, but where are we going, right? And I don't know what to think about that, because I can't believe that where we've been going is where we're going to keep going. I can't believe that that the economic conditions that we live under are sustainable, and therefore I think along with everyone else, not just artists, but particularly maybe artists, because artists have their particular parasitic relationship to wealth. I don't necessarily think that planning for a continuation of the present dispensation in which the art market expands as almost everything else falls apart, because there's a constant upward redistribution of income to the top, not even 1%, but 0.1%. I just don't believe that that's going to sustain itself. So what the artist must do to be prepared to live in the future is a very is something very nebulous.
I mean, we're talking, you know, economically in some ways. I mean, it seems to me there's also an issue of politics. As artists want to make money, enter the market, or continue what seems, as you're saying, an unsustainable system, essentially, they're looking for the 1%, right? They're trying to get work bought by, or co-opted, perhaps, you know, by collectors who may not really be the best ones to have their work, period. I mean, I know when part of my thinking of that comes out of going to undergraduate school at SUNY Purchase, and the sociology classes I was taking then was saying, look at David Solly's work. Who is he selling this work to? What does that mean, that they're buying his work? It seems that he's kind of this bourgeois artist that's whose message isn't getting out into the world. It's being produced and bought and co-opted and consumed by this kind of fiscally elite group. Should artists be thinking in opposite terms of that? I just recently interviewed Ida Applebrug, and she was talking about how horrified she was at the David Zwirner article in the New Yorker magazine recently, and how she didn't come from that at all. She was giving away things, and now, of course, she's represented by Hauser and Wirth, and it's though she continues to make disturbing, difficult work, she has, in a sense, been co-opted by that system, perhaps. But nevertheless, she comes from an ethic that it's not about sales. It's not about the money. Is that something, do you think, that artists should keep in mind now? Or as we move into the future? Because we wonder what's happening economically or sustainable. Mm-hmm. That sounds like we wonder if they can still continue this model of my work will be sold. But should there be a whole different way of looking at what it means to be an artist in the future?
Well, you have to look. You have to live, and that means that you have to do something that's economically viable, or else, like Duchamp, decide to radically sever your art from that and do it in another way. But either through your art, or through something tangential to your art, or through something totally unrelated to your art, you have to make a living. And that's not going to change. So I guess the question is, well, what route can an artist follow to find a way to do that that healthily works for them? And I think that's always been different for different people, given their capacities and their different talents and different desires and so on. All I'm saying is that although people keep talking about the idea that there's an art market bubble and the idea that this bubble has to burst, and we don't see any end to the, I don't think it's exactly a bubble, because I think given the conditions that we have today, it can keep expanding. But I think the underlying conditions that have nothing to do with art could very well change radically. And I don't think the results of that are predictable, if that's true. They're totally not predictable. So I don't even know how to begin to think about how to prepare oneself. Just like I don't, I try and think about, well, how am I going to live when I can't work anymore, and our, the savings that my wife and I, that we have in the bank, are they going to be sufficient to, to allow us not to be, 80-year-old people eating cat food or whatever? You don't really know. You just have to try and do your best and do what feels right. But there's no predicting that you're not going to make the wrong move. I mean, I know I have a friend who comes from a different kind of background than I come from, and this person inherited a good bit of money from her father, and when her father died and whoever it was advising her what to do, and the advisor said, well, your father's been making really good money on his investment from this guy that's handling the investments up until now, and if I were you, I'd just keep it with that same investment advisor, Bernard Madoff. That person's life has changed radically in a way that she never would have predicted, because she thought she would have X and now she has X minus Y, and is learning to live with that. You just don't know.
Barry, thanks so much for talking with us today. I really enjoyed
it. It's been fun.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.